Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radio Lab.
Radio Lab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Okay, let's see. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, is this Errol Morris?
I think it's me.
Hello, this is Jad from Radio Lab.
Hi, thank you for your very, very nice but somewhat disturbing email.
What disturbed you in the email?
The term truth fascist.
You called Errol Morris a truth fascist? What were you thinking?
I wrote him an email to try and get him to come talk to us. And I don't know why I use that.
What is a truth fascist?
That was meant lovingly, I should say.
Ah!
Wasn't exactly the right choice of words. Fundamentalist?
Oh, I like it.
But really what I meant is, like, this is a guy who's always trying to get to the bottom of things. He's made all these documentaries, Thin Blue Line.
Oh, yeah.
Got a guy off death row, actually, in A Thin Blue Line. He made The Fog of War.
He made Vernon, Florida.
Yeah, but I contacted him because, you know, I'd recently seen him give this talk about this one investigation of his that, for me, is like the purest example of the thing that drives him, the thing that's in all of his films, this desire, relentless desire to figure things out, to get to
truth!
And it all starts with a photograph.
One of the very, very first photographs of war, 1855.
Which war?
This is the Crimean War that involved Great Britain, France, Russia, the Ottoman Empire, and believe it or not, Sardinia.
The fighting took place in what is now basically the Ukraine. The Russians were on one side, everybody else on the other. 500,000 people died. It was incredibly brutal.
And there's this photograph titled The Valley of the Shadow of Death. It's black and white. It shows a dirt road cutting through this landscape.
Just one dirt road between two hills.
There's nobody in the photograph.
No birds, no trees, no people.
There's really nothing living in the photograph.
Not even grass.
Nothing.
But as you stare at this road a little more closely, you realize why nothing is living in this photograph. Because this road is
littered with cannonballs. Cannonballs everywhere.
As soon as you notice them, the photograph springs to life.
You imagine this fusillade of artillery fire raining down on this landscape. This is one really fascinating thing about photography. It's a time machine. There's a physical connection between that photograph and that world.
Because you're holding this piece of film that was literally ripped right out of that world.
But the context is gone.
And more importantly, in this case, you don't even know if that picture is true.
What do you mean?
It turns out that this photograph is one of a pair. There is a second photograph exactly the same as the first photograph.
Exact same camera position.
But in this other photograph, the cannonballs that were on the road are gone.
So one has cannonballs on the road and one has cannonballs not on the road, but otherwise they're completely identical.
Yes.
You thought, that's weird. Let me look into that.
And there was a passage in...
And he ends up reading this essay by Susan Sontag,
where she talks about these photographs as though it's just obvious what was going on.
And he was like, oh, that word.
Well, I don't like the word obvious.
Susan Sontag was basically arguing that the guy who took the picture, Roger Fenton, came to an empty road, put the cannonballs on the road. He staged it.
Yes.
It's obvious.
But
that word.
Nothing's so obvious that it's obvious. And so I started investigating.
And so began a ludicrous, obsessive, dogged, but kind of sublime pursuit of this slippery little fact that actually inspired this whole hour.
Right, today on Radiolab, we're going to bring you stories about our insatiable desire to find out what we cannot, should not, and the world tells us we must not know. We want to know anyway, and we will spare nothing to find out.
I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
Back to Errol Morris.
I track down Fenton's letters from the Crimea, journals, written records of soldiers who were in that area at that given time.
Didn't find much.
I interviewed 5 historians. 2 ordered the photographs in one way.
Saying, yes, it's obvious he posed the pictures.
2.
This is a bit of a surprise.
Ordered the photographs in the opposite way.
Really?
They told him it is actually very possible that Fenton saw the cannonballs, took the picture, and then soldiers came along, took the cannonballs off the road to recycle them so they could fire them back at the Russians.
Exactly.
Was that kind of recycling common practice?
Yes, indeed it was, actually.
So you had a tie. 2 historians saying he faked it, 2 saying he didn't.
And the 5th...
tiebreaker.
Jump back and forth.
I like that you tried to call him the tiebreaker, that he didn't break the tie.
Well, of course, none of these things is subject to vote. Truth isn't something that you vote on.
At this point, he says he was feeling a very familiar...
irritation.
He thought, you know what, forget historical interpretations.
What if I could, from the photograph itself, the very photograph itself, determine which photograph came first?
From just the photos.
So I started A-B-ing the photographs.
Just sort of superimposing them on each other and flipping back and forth.
A, B, B, A, A, B, B, A, etc., etc.
Nothing. And then he thinks,
I know what I can do. I can start studying the shadows.
Which meant,
yeah, let's go to the Crimea.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
His reasoning was, I can't study the shadows unless I know the exact direction the camera was pointing on that day in 1855, which means I need to find the exact spot where Fenton stood.
And I had terrible trouble finding this place.
Is it marked?
No! All of the guides kept taking me to the Charge of the Light Brigade, that site where Tennyson wrote about the Valley of Death. No, 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 not the Valley of Death. The Valley of the Shadow of Death. But finally...
a guide named Olga...
she was fabulous.
...helps him locate the spot.
It's completely desolate, undeveloped...
still, after 150 years. With some trial and error, he's able to figure out that Fenton was facing north when he took those photos, and then he goes off to the Crimean War Museum and asks them,
could I borrow some cannonballs?
Oh, man.
I take the cannonball, take it out to the Valley of the Shadow of Death, and I photograph it.
At different times of the day, hoping that he'd be able to see subtle differences in the shadows cast by those cannonballs that could help him order the photos.
But nothing.
Nothing?
There was endless questions about cloud cover, whether you could even measure the shadows on these photographs.
In fact, he now suspects that the shadows in those old pictures may not have been shadows at all.
But just artifacts of how the prints were made, and on and on.
So was the trip useful at all?
Not so much.
How many days did you spend photographing and examining the photographs of cannonballs on the road?
I was there for about a week.
And then he went home with no answer to his question, only that continuing...
irritation.
But he was like, no.
No!
Not done yet.
Look, when you investigate anything, I don't care what it is, whether it's a Fenton photograph or Abu Ghraib or... the Murrah Vidalis police officer. Yes, complications result. Thinking causes complications. I'm sorry. But it's part of that process that we go through of trying to figure out what's out there in the world. What really happened. This is about truth. Absolute truth. And... the pursuit of truth, properly considered, shouldn't stop short of insanity. So, yes, the Fenton photographs worried me that I might not be able to resolve it to my satisfaction.
But then he's at a party, and he bumps into a friend of his, a guy by the name of Dennis Purcell.
Who is very, very good with Photoshop.
We called him up.
Hello.
Turns out...
well, I'm an optical engineer.
So he's not just good at Photoshop, he actually builds high-tech cameras. In any case, they were talking at this party.
And the Fenton picture came up.
Errol told him...
he had this problem of wondering which came first and said, could you take a look at these?
Dennis takes the pictures home, puts them in his computer.
And I immediately started to compare them.
Right away, he starts noticing differences between the two.
The light changed. The weather was different. Shadows.
But he comes to pretty much the same conclusion as Errol, that those things ultimately don't help. So he just starts flipping between the photos.
Flipping them back and forth.
Back and forth between the two photographs.
On the road.
Flip.
Off the road.
Flip.
On the road.
Flip.
Off the road.
Flip.
He's doing this for hours. Off the road.
Flip.
On the road. Flip. And then he sees it.
The rocks on the left-hand side.
This little group of pebbles up on the left bank. Every time he flipped back and forth.
Flip, flip.
Those little rocks.
Popped out.
They moved. Just a little bit. And when he zoomed in, he could see that there were five of them.
Fred, George, Oswald, Lionel, and Marmaduke.
We named them, yes.
These five guys shifted from one photo to the next. And here's the key. In the picture where the road was empty, they were a little bit higher on the hill. When the road was full of cannonballs, those little rocks shift down.
Maybe 8 inches or 9 inches.
And from the direction of that movement, you could order the photographs.
It's basically like this. You could say some rocks fell down the hill. They went from up on the hill to down. Up goes before down. And if the up photo is the empty road and the down photo is the road full of cannonballs, well then...
The one with the cannonballs on the road was the second picture.
Imagine the scene.
Fenton comes upon an empty road, but he sees cannonballs on the hill. So he and...
Whoever was helping him would have walked along the sides of the road and lifted up cannonballs, moved them onto the road. In that process, they would have invariably knocked into rocks.
And rocks don't fall uphill.
They only fall downhill.
It's gravity.
So case closed? This has been resolved?
Yeah. I think it has.
So Susan Sontag was right.
For the wrong reasons.
But she was right. Fenton staged the photograph. So in addition to being one of the first photographs of war, this is one of the first photographic lies.
I guess he just figured it was a better photo.
Yeah. Or you could say...
Fenton was a coward.
Maybe he didn't want to get too close to the actual fighting, so he
put the cannonballs on the road to make it look a lot more dangerous than it would have otherwise.
Or maybe he was after some kind of
emotional truth.
That's what Dennis Purcell thinks.
It's obvious why he did it.
There's that word again.
To make it look the way it felt. To put those cannonballs on the road is how you felt when you were there.
In which case, he would argue that the second photo, the one he posed, is more authentic than the first.
But forget all of that. Who in hell knows what Fenton was thinking? I really don't know what his motivation was.
But isn't that kind of the question at the end of the day?
Do I really care whether he put the cannonballs on the road or not?
Well,
I
hope you do.
I hope you do.
Don't you?
I do and I don't.
Really?
Why would you go through all this then?
I guess this is what I take from it. In flipping back and forth between those two photographs.
Flip.
He says you see the rocks move.
Flip.
And when you see the rocks move.
Flip.
You imagine feet kicking those rocks.
Flip.
And when you imagine feet.
Flip.
Kicking those rocks.
Flip.
You feel.
Flip.
The soldiers walking.
Like, really feel it.
You feel them hitting into the rocks. You feel, on some deep sense for me, the reality of that scene in a way that I would not have felt otherwise. It's almost as if you've walked through a pinhole camera into the past. That world in which the photograph, that strange, temporal, evanescent world in which we live is gone.
But if you can step between these photographs, you are permitted a brief trespass into something that you thought was lost.
Yes. My father died when I was 2 years old. And perhaps the deepest, one of the deepest mysteries of my life Who was he? Here are all these photographs around the house. I was very, very young. I have no memories of him. There's a mystery about this man who is central to my life in so many ways, but who I don't know. And who I never will know.
Big thanks to Errol Morris. This segment was actually taken from one of his books, a great book called Believing is Seeing, and more information on that on our website, radiolab.org. Thanks also to Ira Glass for helping us get in touch with Errol.
It's interesting to think about what Errol Morris did, because it's kind of heroic in a way, because we all live in the arrow of time, and as best we can tell, at least in the world where we live, time seems to move in only one direction, that is forward into the future. You never see milk suddenly fly out of the tea back into the milk pouring pitcher. Just doesn't happen. Mm. But people do try. We met, who was it?
There was a neuroscientist,
yes,
David Eagleman.
David Eagleman.
I mean, it was more of a thought experiment, really, something he'd heard about. But he was thinking aloud about how might one recover like a set of ideas, like a lost language, right? I think the stat is something like every 14 days a language is lost because the last speaker of that language dies and, you know, takes the language.
With her,
right,
him.
Exactly. So how might you recover something like a dead language, a long dead language? And he just tossed this one out.
For example, nobody knows what Latin sounds like, right? It's dead because all the people who spoke Latin, there weren't tape recorders around when they were doing it. And so essentially we all say, all right, it's dead. It's gone. But it turns out somebody made a proposal that probably wouldn't work, but it was so stunning in its creativity that I thought it was very interesting, which is, he said, look, sometimes these Roman pottery makers, if you can imagine these wheels that turn, these pottery wheels, and you have a little stylus against the piece of pottery to make the line that spirals down. He said if there were people talking in the room while that was happening, there might be micro vibrations that caused the stylus to move in and out. And as a result, it essentially could act like a record. And if you could play it back from these pieces of Roman pottery, you could actually hear the people in the room talking in Latin.
Aha! Wow. You could play a vase like an LP and then hear like Prothethius, you know, the potter, you could hear his voice?
Precisely. Now, the thing is, it probably won't work exactly like that. But what's interesting about the idea is that we're constantly coming up with new technologies where then we can retrieve things that we once thought were dead. In other words, we thought the information sort of scattered off into the universe. And then we're finding with a new technology, we're able to bring it all back together.
What was that? What was that?
Those are dead languages coming back. I don't know what that is. It was probably from a sound effects
library. So all those languages that were disappearing, that's their return?
It was a gesture. I was trying to evoke the sense of languages returning from the cosmos.
Brilliantly done.
We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dennis Purcell.
Hi, this is Errol Morrison. He is about to read the credits for you. Here you go.
Here we go. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation
and
the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation,
enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is produced by WNYC
and distributed by
NPR.
That finishes the credits. Bye.
End of message.
Hi there, I'm Monica calling from Seoul, South Korea. Radiolab is supported by MailChimp, celebrating creativity, chaos, and teamwork since 2001. More at MailChimp.com.